This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Law Report. Damien Carrick with you. Coming up later, Portugal's unique approach to drug addiction. First to Canada, where the Supreme Court recently handed down a decision that effectively prevents a private Christian university from opening a law school. Why? Because the court found that Trinity Western University effectively locked out LGBTIQ students. This ruling follows hot on the heels of the US Supreme Court decision in Masterpiece Bakery versus the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. That's the one which involved a Christian baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. Both these disputes centre on the hot-button culture war issue of where you draw the line between freedom of religion and equal opportunity. On this side of the Pacific, Canadian law professor Ian Benson, who's based at Notre Dame University in Sydney, and associate professor Luke Beck from Monash University in Melbourne have been closely following these decisions. Trinity Western University has a code of conduct that all staff and students have to follow. I asked Ian Benson, what does this code of conduct require of staff and students?
Yeah, well, it's called the Community Covenant, and essentially what it does is it sets out a variety of rules that govern their community there at this Trinity Western University. It covers matters such as alcohol consumption, pornography watching, and their approach to sexuality, which certainly wouldn't be for everyone, but for this evangelical Christian university, it states that sexual relations should be within marriage. That means it excludes heterosexuals who are wanting to have sex as well outside of marriage, and obviously it excludes LGBT sex because they define marriage as male and female, which is typical for a Orthodox religious tradition such as evangelical Protestantism.
So law societies in two Canadian provinces, Ontario and British Columbia, were very uncomfortable with this code and said they would refuse to admit law graduates from this law school into the legal profession. What was the reasoning of the law society in objecting to this code of conduct?
Right. Well, let me just answer that bluntly. What they said was that they chose to characterize this as the exclusion of LGBT and other sexual identity groups from that community. But rather than looking at diversity as living together with people who disagree with you about sex, which is what's really at issue here, although no one wants to discuss that, rather than discussing that, they went into a very interesting approach argued for by many parties before the court, that this was had to be understood as an exclusion of one group of people, and that was the LGBT group. They never mentioned the heterosexuals who were excluded from this covenant as well.
The dispute went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. And what did the majority decide? I mean, I know it was a 7-2 decision, but what essentially was the thinking of the majority here?
Well, the majority judges said very clearly that the existence of a covenant of the sort that Trinity had was a exclusion of LGBT students and others, I presume, that didn't fit the covenant, and therefore it constituted an impermissible rule by this private university.
And what do you think of this decision?
I think it's appalling because I don't welcome the state telling private associations, even if they have a connection with a public thing like law, what they have to believe and what line they have to toe. So in other words, diversity, though diversity was used as the argument in favor of the LGBT students, it ended up in the result being a comedy, a bad comedy about diversity, because in fact, this entire religious group is now, and this would have been the first religious law-based law school in Canada, is excluded from having an accredited law program.
Associate Professor Luke Beck, can I bring you in here? Do you see it that way? Do you see it as excluding Christians from the legal profession, as opposed to ensuring that the door remains open for LGBTIQ students?
Not at all. So what went on here is that the Canadian provincial law societies refused to accredit the law program at this university because the university had an admissions policy that for all practical intents and purposes said no gays allowed. And one of the things that the law societies have to take into account in deciding whether or not to accredit programs is the public interest. And so the law societies came to the view that it was contrary to the public interest to have an accredited law program where gays were excluded from being admitted. And so that does not have the effect of saying that evangelical Christians are ineligible to join the legal profession. Evangelical Christians are eligible to apply for admission to any other law school in Canada. The concern of the law societies was that by saying no gay is allowed in this law school, you would in effect be limiting the ability of gay people to join the legal profession by cutting them off from one port of entry, which obviously you have to go through a law school to get into the legal profession. And the Supreme Court of Canada agreed with them. They said that just because Trinity Western University has a religious belief that sex between people of the same sex, that gay sex is wrong, they don't get to impose that on other people. They can choose not to engage in same-sex sexual relations if they wish, but they can't impose that on other people by saying no gay is allowed at this law school if they want to have government accreditation.
Ian Benson, what's your response to that, that you're shutting the door to a community as opposed to opening it up to all?
We do that all the time in free societies. We have rules in all kinds of areas, employment, for example, in which we exclude whole groups of people on grounds that otherwise we wouldn't allow. For example, no one would, I think, reasonably argue that a synagogue couldn't have a Jewish rabbi. We allow religious discrimination. We allow disability discrimination because we allow certain kinds of employees to have fitness rules related to the job requirements. And we have age restrictions as well. We don't allow children to drive cars for good reasons. Now here, what's happening is that a moral disagreement about sexuality, that's the core of these cases. We'll talk about the American one in a minute, but the core of these cases is disagreement about sexual conduct. And what's interesting is it's being euphemistically characterized as an exclusion of people and a rejection of equality. But in fact, equality logically has to follow our understanding of diversity. Genuine diversity actually allows communities to coexist that disagree. Remember, this isn't racism. This isn't saying we're not going to allow blacks here. This is saying we're not going to allow certain kinds of conduct here.
It's exactly the same as saying no blacks allowed, because what this policy's effect is, its practical effect, is that no gays are allowed. To dress it up in the euphemism of saying, well, gays are allowed to come to this law school if they choose to refrain from engaging in sex, is just a bit cute. The practical operation of this policy is no gays allowed.
And well, no, that's no, and no sexually functioning heterosexuals are allowed either if they are not married. So this is a community, as I said, with which not everyone's going to agree with their ethos that they're trying to create. But the fact of the matter is it's perfectly legitimate so far, and I don't know how long it'll continue, but it's legitimate so far to say that holding the view that marriage should be only male and female is not illegal. And in Canada, we're stepping towards increasingly, step by step, a kind of pejorative reading of the male-female conception of marriage. That's starting to be stigmatized as almost a hatred view. And I think that's very dangerous.
Holding the view is fine. The problem is imposing that view on other people and limiting access to joining the legal profession because of religious beliefs. You don't get to use your religious beliefs to decide who can and can't join the legal profession. And that was the concern of the law society.
No, I think that this case is dressed up as standing for diversity when, in fact, it undercuts diversity. There was zero evidence that any gay or lesbian had ever wanted to go to that law school in the first place. There was no evidence of it.
If I operated a law school and had a whites-only admissions policy, would I be allowed to get away with that just because I could prove that no black student had ever applied?
Absolutely not, because racism is not a good analogy. Racism is not based on what you choose to do with your sexual practices. Remember, there was no restriction here on gays or lesbians going to that law school in the same way as there's no restrictions to sexually active heterosexuals going to that law school. All the law school said was, our community covenant is, if you are going to be sexually active, you have to be a married heterosexual.
Let's move on. The Canadian Supreme Court decision comes just a week or so after the decision of the US Supreme Court decision in Masterpiece Cake Shop and the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. Luke Beck, very, very briefly, tell me what was at the heart of that case? What were the facts in that case?
The underlying facts of this case were that a same-sex couple, two men who were due to get married, went to a cake shop called Masterpiece Cake Shop and ordered a wedding cake for their wedding. And the gentleman who runs this cake shop said, no, I have a sincerely held religious belief that same-sex marriage is wrong. I refuse to make your wedding cake for you. So the engaged couple complained to the Colorado Civil Rights commission about discrimination, about being discriminated against on the grounds of their sexuality, about being denied equal treatment. And the commission found in favour and said, yes, indeed, there had been discrimination.
The Colorado Civil Rights Commission said, look, essentially, you're discriminating against this couple. You're not offering equal access to goods and service as you're required under anti-discrimination law. It went all the way to the Supreme Court of the USA. What did the majority find and what was the reasoning of the majority? Luke Beck, briefly.
The majority said that the US Constitution's right to freedom of speech and right to religious freedom meant that the Colorado Human Rights Commission had to give this cake shop a fair hearing. So the Supreme Court avoided dealing with what was actually the underlying really interesting, juicy issue about whether somebody can say that because I have a religious belief about something, I'm therefore allowed to have an exemption from regular anti-discrimination laws and my religious beliefs give me a right to discriminate against somebody else. But what they did say, the majority judgment written by Justice Kennedy offered some really strong comments suggesting that if in the future the Supreme Court ever has to deal with that case, they would say no, that a person's individual religious beliefs doesn't give them an effective exemption from the ordinary law. You can't use your religious beliefs to discriminate against other people.
So just to recap, what the court said was that the Baker wasn't given a fair hearing at the initial decision-making level by the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. They just didn't give him a fair hearing. They were dismissive and rude of
him.
That's
right.
And
they were anti-religious bigots is what they were. They analogized his viewpoint to people who supported the Holocaust, for goodness sake. They were administratively biased. They didn't give appropriate neutrality. And my worry of the way that, and I agree with Professor Beck here, that they didn't really get at what he called the juicy issues. They didn't actually deal with the fundamental question of whether in a free and democratic society you can disagree about what I would call and characterize as compelled speech.
In other words, making a cake is an act of creation and you're in fact compelling somebody to do something, to create a speech, to express themselves.
Not all cakes. You see, this guy said he would sell cakes to this couple. He's happy to sell them any cake in his shop except a marriage celebration cake. So, I mean, this sounds silly that we're talking about cakes and flowers and photographers, but it's really important to remember that at the core of this is a genuine moral disagreement about the nature of marriage. The state has no business telling you what form of marriage you must celebrate.
There are two responses to that. Firstly, this claim of religious exemption seems only to be pressed in the case of religious objections to gay weddings, to gay marriages, same-sex marriages. Nobody seems to press for this exemption in the case of people who have genuine religious objections to interracial marriages or genuine religious objections to a marriage involving a divorcee. The second point to make is that for a very long time in Western countries, we've taken the view that a person's own individual beliefs do not give them a right to be immune from the ordinary civil law. A person who is genuinely a racist, for example, can't get away with racial discrimination. A person who is genuinely a sexist can't get away with sex discrimination. And so we've now decided in more recent times that people who want to treat gay people differently to other people are not allowed to do that either.
There's a difference, though, isn't there, between offering to sell somebody an undecorated cake and selling them a cake which is imbued with meaning and expression as decorated by the cake maker. Now, people might say that's not Picasso, perhaps, but it is something. It is an expression of values and of creativity.
Yes, it is. That's an important distinction. It's not a trivial distinction. It's very important.
Nobody is forcing anybody to create a wedding cake for anybody, but the law says that if you voluntarily enter into the retail business of making wedding cakes and creating designer wedding cakes, you have to do so on equal terms. You can't discriminate based on sex.
That's euphemistic,
you can't discriminate based on sex,
with respect,
and you can't discriminate based on sexuality.
That's a euphemism.
Well,
you are forcing them to make the cake. You're saying you're not forced to make the cake, but you have to make the cake. That's forcing them to make the cake. The word discrimination is being used loosely here. The word equality is being used loosely to force people against their wills to do things. And I reject that.
That was a voluntary choice. You can't choose to deny service to black people. You can't choose to deny service
not an analogy.
To Jews or to gays.
No, those are not analogies. Being gay is not the issue. It's celebrating gay marriage. This man did not refuse to sell cakes to gay people. That's a misconstruction of the facts. He said he was happy to sell them any cake in his shop. He would not make them. a celebration cake because that's a speed chuck. It's a speed chuck.
But he's happy to make a celebration cake for straight couples, for black couples, for Jewish couples, for all other couples, except just not gay couples. He was singling out gay couples for different
reasons. Look, this guy, his reasoning could well apply to an example you gave a minute ago, which was divorce. It's quite conceivable that he could refuse to make a cake for a divorced couple remarrying. He could do that, and I would support his right to do that. And I think we need to support more and more in these times the ability of citizens to reject standard positions put forward by government. They're not all the same, and no one should be forced to celebrate a gay marriage.
Professor Ian Benson and Associate Professor Luke Beck, thank you both so much for speaking to the Law Report. A very, very interesting conversation.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Law Professor Ian Benson from Notre Dame University in Sydney, and also Associate Professor Luke Beck from Monash University in Melbourne. This discussion centred on freedom of religion versus equal opportunity for LGBTIQ people. There is an analogous debate around the protection of political activity. Recently, White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders and her family were asked to leave a restaurant because the restaurateur disagrees with Trump administration policies. Luke Beck takes the view that on the one hand, you could describe this ejection as an act of political protest against an extremely powerful person. But on the other hand, he points out that lawful political belief or activity is a protected attribute, like race, gender and disability, in some US and many Australian states. So the refusal of service to a politician could well be unlawful in those jurisdictions. And he points out, of course, what is ethical and what is legal isn't necessarily always the same. Ian Benson puts it this way, quote, "To refuse to serve someone for their political views or their sexual identity should not be allowed. But be careful here. If that restaurant was being asked to make a Make America Great Again cake for Sanders, I would argue that, like the gay wedding celebration cake, the restaurant would be fully justified in refusing to make and sell it. My position here is consistent no matter what the political/moral speech at issue. It isn't just a service issue, since moral/political disagreement is at issue with same-sex marriage and Trump's politics," end of quote. On RN, Radio Australia, News Radio, and on your smart device, this is The Law Report. I'm Damien Carrick. The program's Twitter handle is @LawReportRN, and you can follow me on @Damien_Carrick. Canada has just legalised marijuana. It's following in the footsteps of 9 US states. Of course, different countries all have very different legal responses to drug use. Portugal has gone down the path of decriminalisation, not legalisation. The possession of drugs for personal use is not a criminal offence. Instead, you receive something akin to an infringement notice, as you might for a traffic offence in this country. Manuel Cardoso is the deputy head of Portugal's Drugs and Addiction Authority. He says that Portugal at the turn of the century was facing a horrendous heroin epidemic and it needed to try something new.
We face also a big infectious disease prevalence. 60% of HIV infection was addicts. When asked what was the main problem that they could face, Portuguese said that the drug addiction was the worst.
So Portugal decided to embark on a radical reform. What radical reform did you embrace?
Portugal decriminalized the use of drugs.
Decriminalization for drug possession, is that right?
Decriminalization for use and a possession of all drugs.
So if you were caught with 10 days or less the drugs for your personal use, then you wouldn't be arrested or sentenced or go to jail or get a criminal record. It would be the equivalent of a traffic offence.
Yes, perfect. It's just like you said. It's not permitted, but it was not anymore like a criminal offence.
You would still be guilty of a criminal offence if you are trafficking or selling large amounts of the drugs, and if that's your business, that's still illegal and a crime.
Absolutely.
But to be a user, to be an addict, to be a recreational user, no longer is a criminal offence.
Absolutely.
What happens to people who are caught with 10 days or less of a drug, who are caught in possession of drugs?
If you don't apply to the rules to the traffic, for instance, and the police officer give you a fine or something like that. Here, the situation is more complicated. You are facing not administrative offense that can be solved by a fine. And that's why the Portuguese government create a commission to evaluate the risk consumption of these people. It could be an addict, it could be need treatment, but it could be an occasional consumption. And in that case, the process is slightly different. If you need treatment, the individual is sent to a treatment center. If not, other measures are applied. But the idea is dissuade the consumption of the drug.
So the idea is there's this commission, a panel of three people, I think a psychiatrist and a social worker from the health side and a legal advisor or a lawyer. They focus on identifying if somebody's an addict and then if they are, sending them to treatment.
Yeah.
But what happens if somebody just refuses to attend the panel or just ignores what the panel offers them in terms of treatment?
It occurs, but it's not the common way. But no penalty at the moment is applied at these people.
Mm. So Manuel Cardoso, has this system been a success?
97% of all those that the police sent to the commission went there. Then 75%. After the process in the commission, change their relation with the consumption. And so this is in the process. Looking at our problems facing this addiction related to consumption or to problematic addiction, we have now from heroin 27,000 in treatment. Maybe the estimation we have is around 40,000 people with problems, heroin consumption problems. The prevalence of HIV or the relation of the HIV infection, the addicts represent on 3%. Instead, there's the 60% in 97. And the overdoses that we have 35 more or less in the eight, in 97, 98, 35 per million inhabitants. Nowadays we have 2.7. We had 27 in 2016. We have 10 million inhabitants, so 2.7% of inhabitants. So in all fields, the problematic indicators we had are decrease really a lot, including in the justice field, the problems are reduced too.
What do you mean? Do you mean the crime rate has fallen? The property crime associated with stealing for addiction. So that has fallen, has it?
Yes, a lot. And looking at the prevalence consumption of all drugs, I can say that it's still more or less the same. We have in the last survey a slight increase on cannabis consumption. But in the survey before, we had a significant decrease. So nowadays we maintain more or less at the same level. We score in Europe in the bottom of the scale for cannabis and for the other drugs in the very bottom of the scale. So even on that, we don't add an increase of the consumptions of any drug, including in youth. In the last survey, we have a slight decrease on the consumptions at 16. And the main drug is cannabis, and we score pretty well on that.
As you point out, it's decriminalisation, and that's different from legalisation. So
absolutely.
You can't smoke a joint in a cafe or on the street, and you can't inject heroin or another drug in a park or on the street. They're still illegal, and drugs are still confiscated by police.
Yes, the drug is still confiscated, but it's not permitted. The idea is clear that is not permitted, but never this consumer goes to jail or to prison because of that.
In recent years, the number of people in Australian prisons has risen. What about the numbers of prisoners in Portuguese prisons? Is that increasing, and has that increased over the period of this reform?
The absolute number are decreased, and the proportion of people in prison related with crimes related with drugs are decreased too. So nowadays our prisons are less people and less related with drugs.
So what happens though if somebody continues with their addiction and they continue to steal to support their addiction? I mean, at some point...
Steal is a crime.
It's still a crime. And they still go to jail for that kind of...
But what happened is that with in our system, and because decriminalization, it's not a panacea, it's not a miracle, we create a comprehensive approach to help these people in all areas, since the prevention, treatment, harm reduction and reintegration. These people need to be helped. And we look at what we face in all contexts you live. We look at the stage of age you are. So we look at family you live with, and if you have or not training abilities to have a job, if you have home, we look at this at the same time, trying to help people in looking between all angles possible. That's make also the difference. Anyone who asks for treatment has treatment in a week, 10 days in maximum, and many kinds of treatment. This therapist identify the needs and try to send them to the treatment they need.
Manuel Cardoso, thank you. Thank you very much for speaking to the Law Report. It's a fascinating discussion of a very different system that we know very little about.
Thank you. Myself, it's a pleasure to be here.
Manuel Cardoso, Deputy Head of Portugal's Drugs and Addiction Authority. He recently visited Australia to speak to a conference on therapeutic interventions. It was organised by NADA, the Network of Alcohol and Other Drugs Agencies. On next week's Law Report, we hear two very personal stories of drug addiction and drug-related crime and what it takes to break the cycle. They're extraordinary conversations. Thanks to producer Anita Barrow and to sound engineer this week, Jack Montgomery Parks. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more Law.